Welcome to Chapter 11, Diversification and Risky Asset Allocation. In this presentation, we are going to essentially go back to the very beginning of the semester and tie everything together. It is my hope that after this presentation, you will have a very good big picture idea of what it's like to invest in the major forms of investment, stocks and bonds, mutual funds and the like. In my undergraduate years, I was a math major, and I took this one class with a brilliant professor, but we were so, all of us were completely confused about what he was doing. And towards the end of the semester, he said, "Well, now I know many of you are still struggling and not quite catching what we're doing, but in this presentation, I hope to tie everything together, and I think you'll find that what we've done in the past will make a whole lot of sense." Well, after the presentation, we all looked at each other. Do you know what that? I don't know what the hell. Forget it. I'm completely lost. So I hope that doesn't happen to you, dear students. I always think about that whenever I do this one, whenever we work on this one, because it reminds me of my math years. But I think not. I think this one will really tie it all together, so to speak. So let's get started on slide number 2. Diversification. Now, we've already discussed this, right? You don't buy just one stock. You don't buy just one bond. You diversify. You spread your investments across a number of asset classes to eliminate some, but not all, of the risks of investing. You've heard the saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket, right? Exactly. But there's an oppositional saying. There's a saying as opposed to that that says you should put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket, which is kind of silly, and it's supposedly a quote from Mark Twain, but I don't know that it really is. You could look it up and see if it's really Mark Twain, because a lot of things that are attributed to Mark Twain, he really didn't say. But that's okay. It doesn't matter. He was a great guy. He deserves the credit anyway. Yeah, sure. Put all your eggs in one basket. Watch that basket fall. And yeah, exactly. So no, I'm not a big fan of that. I like diversification. Slide number 3. Here is a graph that shows us who the market leaders were between 1989 and 2013. And it shows us one of the best ways to reduce risk as measured by standard deviation, which is, you know, not a very good measurement to begin with of risk, was simply to diversify, to move all your money around so that it's not all in one place. And diversification guarantees that something you own will not do well in any one year. Exactly. Well, wait a minute. No, that's not the way to say it, Piano. The way to say it is diversification, it gives us the knowledge, gives us the comfort that something that we own is going to do well. I mean, a couple of things are going to do horribly, but something is going to do well. And the corollary to that is something you own is not going to do very well. But what I want you to take away from this graph is look at how cash did. The cash meaning money markets, savings accounts, CDs. And not once in those 25 years, did cash outperform any of the other asset classes. You see that? So it really does make a case for people, if they're in it for the long term, to not keep their money in a savings account or a money market or a CD. If you're in it for the short term, well, of course, then you have to put your money in a savings account because it has to be guaranteed. But we're talking long term. And you talk to people who have everything in their 401k in the money market or everything in their Roth IRA at the credit union, and you just, you know, I don't know what to do. You don't know what to say. What can you say? But But look at how well, interestingly, emerging markets did. Right, the last 25 years has seen the emerging markets just explode. But also notice that sometimes they are the sub-emerging markets. Right, well, 2008, everybody fell down. Except for U.S. Treasury bonds, of course, because that's called the flight to quality. People run to the Treasury when they see other things going down. So even in 2008, cash didn't do as well. Now, cash did better than many corporate bonds and some muni bonds. Yeah, because they fell quite a bit. But notice the run-up at the late 1990s of U.S. large company stocks. And the tech sector did even higher than this, only to then fall. Yeah, right, exactly. So that's why we diversify, right? And notice that 2013 was a very, very good year for U.S. stocks and for global stocks, international stocks, but definitely for the United States. And look at cash. Yeesh, nothing. Slide number four. But this brings us back to the question that we asked back in chapter one. How do you measure risk? How do you measure risk? Well, there's really no good way to do it. Back in chapter one, we introduced the tug of war between risk and return. And we saw how higher the average annual return of the investment, the higher the standard deviation and the companion measure variance from the average annual return. Which means if we want high return, we're going to see our investment bounce up and down quite a bit. The standard deviation, the variance, is going to be large. And we have studied the major financial asset classes. We've looked at mutual funds, stocks, bonds, and cash. We discussed the risks and the returns of each. And we found that risk return is easy to measure. How much money did you make? How much did you start with? How much did you make? How long did it take? That's your return. But risk was very difficult to measure, and it's even harder to anticipate. 2008, everybody went down unless your idea of diversification was U.S. Treasury bonds and money market accounts. And even then, the Treasury bonds did better. Mm-hmm. So, slide number five, back to variance and standard deviation. The variance and its more useful companion, the standard deviation, tell us how much an asset class, and when we say class, we mean stocks, bonds, mutual funds, that kind of thing, cash investments, will vary from the expected return. We expect to see 8, 9, 10% from stocks over the long term. But are we going to get it in any one year? No. We're going to get 22, minus 5, 6, 17. It's going to bounce all over the place. And we see that these measures are readily available, going online and asking for them, and the numbers ain't pretty. For any randomly selected stock on the New York Stock Exchange, you know, supposedly the most stable stocks of the universe, although some NASDAQ stocks are even bigger, the standard deviation is almost 50%. That means in any one year, many stocks on the New York Stock Exchange, the most stable stocks, right, will vary up or down close to 50% from their average annual return. So how can we reduce the variance? In other words, how can we reduce the risk? The answer on slide six, of course, is to diversify. If we go from one randomly selected stock to two randomly selected stocks, the standard deviation goes from 49.24% down to 37.36%. You see, it drops a big percentage, right? What's that, over 20% by just adding one stock. If we move to 10 stocks, it drops again another big drop from 37% down to almost 24%. And 20 stocks, it drops again, and so on. Diversifying our stock portfolio reduces our risk, as measured by reduced standard deviation, reduced variance, substantially. by buying more than one stock, and you already knew this, right? You understood this. It makes perfect sense. 10 stocks, which is what, 10 to 20 stocks, which is what a typical stock investor, you know, you really can't keep that many stocks because you have to keep track of what's going on. And so, but still, it lowered your standard deviation from 50% down to 21.5%. That's pretty darn good. Right? Yeah. So diversification is a good thing. Looking at the table on slide 7 from your book, it's a little tricky. We're going to see a graph in just a moment, but let's see if we can figure this one out. As we increase the number of stocks in the portfolio from 1 up to 1,000, what we see is the standard deviation at first falling dramatically from almost 50% down to about 20%. But then as we add more and more stocks, we see that the standard deviation just is reduced very, very slightly. So we go from about 100% of 50%, that's what this is, ratio of a single stock, down to about 40% of what the standard deviation is for a single stock. But look, you know, by adding, going from 50 to 100, going from 100 to 200 to 200 to 300, it doesn't really reduce the standard deviation hardly at all. And here is a graph of that table that we just saw. And those of you who are math fans, mathematics, should be able to name what kind of graph we call this. It's a limit. Exactly. It's a limit. By increasing the number of stocks, we can reduce the risk. But after we get to a certain point, adding more and more stocks to our portfolio doesn't really give us any big drop in the standard deviation. There is a limit, and that's the term they use in math, limit, to which diversification can reduce your risk in any given asset class, in this case, stocks. And why is that? Why is there a limit? Slide number 9, correlation. Correlation is the name we give to the phenomenon of the tendency of the returns of two asset classes to move together. And the reason diversification works is because no two investment returns will be exactly the same. And we give that a name, and I want you to remember it. I know it sounds a little highbrow, it sounds a little snooty, but it's called imperfect correlation. The fact that no two investment returns will follow one another exactly the same. Positively correlated assets tend to move up and down together. Negatively correlated assets tend to move in opposite directions. So you make sense? No two investment returns are the same. Investments are imperfectly correlated, and that's the reason that diversification helps to reduce the standard deviation of the portfolio. But the problem is, slide number 10, is that many stocks are positively correlated with one another. And we calculate, I'm not going to ask you to do it, folks. It's already done. It's on the website. You don't have to worry. I mean, it's on the, when you do your research, we're going to do the research for mutual funds, but still, if you do the calculations, you'll find you calculate what's called the correlation coefficient. And again, we'll leave that to your statistics class. We don't have to do that. We just look it up. It's a measure of how closely returns on assets move together. So it goes from -1, negative 100%, up to 0 to 100%. So if two assets are perfectly negatively correlated, the correlation coefficient will be -1, minus 100%. If they have no correlation whatsoever, then it would be 0%. And if they are perfectly positively correlated, then it would be 100%. And mathematicians often use the variable R. I don't know, correlation, coefficient, I don't know why, but they use the variable R to denote correlation. So if it's perfect negative correlation, that means they're going to go in opposite directions perfectly. If it's perfect positive correlation, they're going to go together up and down. And that's what we are trying to show you on this graph from your book on slide number 11. The first two assets, in this case security A and security B, they could come up with better names, don't you think, are perfectly positively correlated. Because when one goes up, the other goes up. Now, the one goes up higher than the other one, and then when one goes down, they both go down, the one goes down lower than the other one, but the idea is they move in what we say lockstep. One goes up, the other goes up. One goes down, the other goes down. They are positively, perfectly positively correlated. This second graph shows two investments that are perfectly negatively correlated. The one goes up, the other one goes down. The other one goes up, the first one goes down. So you see that? They are completely out of phase, we sometimes say. They're completely opposite of one another. And then this third graph I don't think is really that good because it looks kind of like they are positively correlated. But the idea is this graph is trying to show you that they have no correlation. They're completely unrelated. One goes up, the other one might go up, might go down, might stay sideways. The other one stays sideways, the other one goes up, down. That's a correlation of 0%. But if you look at it, it looks kind of like they're correlated, doesn't it? So ignore that graph. But you understand, they're not supposed to be going in the same direction. And if you do the calculation, you get a zero correlation. That means they don't. They're completely uncorrelated. Slide number 12. So how does this answer our question about why diversification can only reduce by so much the risks of owning stocks? We keep adding more and more stocks, and the standard deviation just goes down a little bit. Although stocks are not perfectly correlated, remember, no two stocks are going to move exactly the same, they are positively correlated enough so that stocks in general tend to move in the same direction. This is why we often refer to stock investments as a whole as the stock market. How's the market doing? Right? Stocks as a whole are going up, or stocks as a whole are going down, or they're staying the same. Even though at any given time some companies are doing well, others are doing poorly, and many are simply chugging along as they've always have done. I mean, even when the market falls 10%, one or two stocks is going to go up. So stock market is the name we give to all the stocks, knowing full well that there are thousands of stocks and they're all very different, but we find that they tend to go up and down together, and that's why adding more stocks to your portfolio doesn't reduce the risk anymore. Once you've gotten 20, 50 stocks in your portfolio, it doesn't reduce it that much. Slide number 13. Darn, darn, darn. That's still too much risk for me, because I don't like risk. I think I'm going to stick to bonds. You are a very conservative, risk-averse investor, and you do not like the volatility of stocks. You don't like it when the market drops about 2 or 3%. Dow, 100 points on the Dow, 200 points on the... Forget the points. Look at the percentages. And so, therefore, you decide to place all your investments into bonds. You will accept the lower return from the bonds in exchange for the lower risk of the bonds. Oops. That was a bad idea. What? Well, yes. If your objective was to reduce risk as measured by standard deviation, which we know is a bad measurement, it was a bad idea. Why? Because stocks, bonds are positively correlated with themselves. They also will tend to do well and do poorly as a whole, as an entire asset class. Remember, interest rates go up, bond prices go down. Interest rates go down, bond prices go up. And it turns out, dear students, that they are often negatively correlated with stocks. When stocks are doing well, it's usually because the economy is doing well, and interest rates, what happens when the interest rates go up? Not always, but that's what normally happens, because there's more economic activity, the demand for money is greater, so interest rates go up. What happens when interest rates go up? You learned that, then you know what happens. Right, bond prices go down. So, yeah, stocks go up, bonds go down. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. What happens in a recession? Stocks get clobbered, but the demand for money is reduced, and what happens to interest rates when the demand for money is reduced? Interest rates go down, bond prices go up. So it turns out that stocks and bonds often, but not always, in 2008, move in opposite directions. That's why we talk about the balanced portfolio. For those people who are really worried about investing, if they own stocks and bonds, it's not a guarantee, but when stocks are doing well, bonds will probably not do very well. They might stay the same. They might actually go down, but not a whole lot. When stocks are doing poorly, bonds often, but not always, will be there to hold up the portfolio, because interest rates are falling, bond prices are responding by going up. Pretty neat, don't you think? I think it is, especially for people who are just terrified. Terrified. Look, here's a balanced fund. Look. Invest in stocks and bonds. And look what happens when the market goes down. The stock market goes down. The bonds actually do well. Not always, but they can't guarantee it. Slide number 14. This graph is from your book, and this has been studied to death. There are some people who think that this is a little bogus, but the vast majority of academics say, no, this is the truth. But there are other people who say, they're not comparing apples to apples. And we'll leave that for another day. If you have a portfolio of 100% stocks, you're going to get the best return. The expected return is the highest, and we're saying about 12%. But you're also going to get the highest standard deviation, 15%, which is about what the S&P 500 has been over the last 80-some-odd years, the standard deviation. As you add bonds to the portfolio, you start reducing the standard deviation and reducing the expected return, right? The return is dropping. Well, that makes sense. Bonds pay less than stocks over the long term. And the standard deviation is going down. Well, that makes sense. Bonds are not as risky as stocks. But you hit this inflection point. You hit this point where as you add bonds, you actually start to raise the standard deviation, but at the same time, reducing the expected return. What a bad deal that is. You're getting more risk as measured by standard deviation, which is an imperfect measurement, and you're getting less return. So many people in the investment world will point to this research and say that's why many folks, especially those who are worried about sleeping at night and they want to sleep well instead of eat well, they're well served by a good balance fund. You know, the balance fund might not do a good job, but that's the mutual fund managers. Slide number 15. This is the graph that we just saw from your book in table form. As we increase the percentage of bonds and decrease the percentage of stocks, they should use percentages, right? They use 1.0 instead of 100%, but you know that's 100%, 95, all the way down to 0%. And the bonds, as we're reducing the stock exposure, we're increasing the bond exposure, and we see the expected return start to fall, until we get to that inflection point down here, and then, the return keeps falling. I'm thinking of the next column. The return, as we increase the number of bonds, we decrease the expected return, we decrease the amount of stocks. But over here in the standard deviation, we see the standard deviation start to fall quickly until we get to that inflection point about right here, about 30% stocks, 70% bonds. And then the standard deviation starts going back up again because bonds are correlated positively with themselves and will tend to go down when interest rates go up and up when interest rates go down. Cool. Isn't this exciting? I think it is. Slide 16. A combination of stocks and bonds actually created a portfolio with less risk as measured by standard deviation, which we've already said is an imperfect measure, while earning you more return than just bonds. If you're seeking less risk, it not only pays to diversify within an asset class, it pays to diversify among asset classes. This is why when people say, well, what about real estate? I say, you know, real estate's great. It's fabulous. It's a pain in the neck. But you're probably going to own your own house someday, so you will have some real estate investment. Because real estate is a raw, remember the PETA factor for mutual funds? Well, we'll talk about the PETA factor. Pain in the, right. For real estate, it's a real pain. And we'll discuss, you know, real estate in a few presentations later. And it won't be, it'll be just a cursory. It won't be an in-depth, because real estate is an entire chapter unto itself. This same kind of relationship occurs with both domestic and foreign stocks and bonds, because sometimes the United States is doing gangbusters, and sometimes the rest of the world is going well, and vice versa. And we saw how well emerging markets have done over the last 25 years. But this global, domestic, international relationship is less pronounced than it was in the past. Why? Because the world is just far more interrelated. It's far more global. And we note for the umpteenth time, for the gazillionth time, that diversification is not a guarantee of positive results. Right. And once you leave the safe confines of the bank, of the mutual fund, money market mutual fund, of the CD, certificate of deposit, the treasury bill, there ain't no guarantees. And as we said, no diversification scheme worked well in 2008. Stocks, bonds, except for treasury bonds, real estate, the precious metals got clobbered, and commodities got clobbered. We have a name for choosing the appropriate mix for an investor. It is called asset allocation, slide number 17. It's a fancy term for how much should I have in stocks, how much should I have in bonds, how much of each stock type, how much of each bond type. You're going to see this formula that has been around for decades, and you notice the number keeps going up, and we'll discuss that in a bit. So you subtract your age from 100, or 110, or 120. Well, I don't understand. Well, that's the percentage of stocks you should own, and the rest should be in bonds. So say you're 40 years old, 100 minus 40 is 60, so you should have 60% in stocks and 40% in your bonds. Well, why are they increasing the number? Well, because people are living longer. So it used to be that somebody who was age 60, well, they might have had 5, 10, 12 years to go. Now they have 20, 30, maybe 40 years. And you millennials, when you're 60 years old, you'll probably have another 50, 60, 70 years. We don't know. We'll find out. I won't. I'll be dead. But you guys will know. Poppycock, say others, myself included. I believe you should buy high-quality stocks, put up with the risk. I'm talking good, you know, I'm not talking the titters and the farce books of the world. I'm talking the Johnson & Johnsons and the GEs I'm not saying you should buy these companies. I'm saying these types of companies, Waste Management Incorporated, which goes out and picks up the trash, that kind of company, you know. You buy these stocks, you hold them, and you put up with the risk, and then once you get near retirement, certainly you're going to start buying bonds because you need that ballast. We use the term ballast so that our portfolio doesn't completely fall over and get swamped. Make sense? I think so. So here's an example. You have $100,000. How do you divvy it up? Well, let's say you think you should have some bonds. Okay, how about 25% or $25,000 in bonds, and the rest, 75%, $75,000 in stocks? And within the bond asset class, you have the majority, 15%, in high-grade quality, high and government bonds, which is by definition high grade. You have 5% in high yield, aka junk bonds, distressed bonds, speculative bonds, and then have some money outside the United States in global bonds. With regard to stocks, you want to have, I think 50% of any portfolio should be in growth and income. That's just my opinion, folks. Others you might think that's too much risk for me, but the numbers show that you're going to do, unless the world ends, and then, oh well. 25,000 in domestic growth and income, 25,000 in global growth and income. And there's going to be a little overlap in there because the global is going to have some domestic, so you still have plenty of United States good companies. And then, okay, 10% is spice in aggressive growth, 10% international, and 5%, folks, stay away from small company stocks. They can just make you really, really rich, or they can make you very sad. So you see, you like that allocation? It's yours. It's yours. Go right ahead and use it with my blessing. On the website, excuse me, I'm going to sneeze. Sorry. Oh. On the website are three... Please, excuse me. I am so sorry. Are three portfolios, three hypothetical illustrations that show what we would do in retirement. And so we'll deal with those on the website in retirement. And we have a slide coming up, so I'm getting a little ahead of myself. But you'll see what happens when we just buy bonds in retirement with a nest egg of $200,000. We just buy stocks in retirement with a nest egg of $200,000. And then we blend the two. 50-50 I used. Okay, make it easy. Slide number 19. Some of those same advisors that suggest asset allocation also suggest the technique of rebalancing. What does rebalancing mean? Every year, you check to see if your percentages are still in balance. And if stocks have had a great year, a banner year, you might now be 70-30 instead of your target 60-40. So what do? You sell enough stocks and buy enough bonds to bring the balance back to that 60-40 allocation. And likewise, if stocks have tanked, you sell bonds and you buy stocks to bring the percentage back up to 60-40. And why is this a good thing? Well, it forces you to do the right thing. Because when stocks are going gangbusters, do you want to sell? That's no fun. You keep seeing them go up and up and up, but your strategy is telling you, well, it's time to take some money off the table, as they say. Take some money off the table, as if it were gambling. And so you're selling high, and if bonds have not done well, you're buying low. And the same thing is true if stocks have gone the other way. You're seeing your bond portfolio do really well. Well, you'll sell some of your bonds and buy some stocks when they're low. So it forces you to buy low, sell high. Is it a guarantee of a successful investment strategy? I didn't hear you. Right. No, it's not a guarantee, but it's a strategy that is employed by many people, and not me so much because I'm a real big stock fan, but everyone's different, and this is a great strategy for people who are especially worried about the stock market. Now, okay, here's where I got a little ahead of myself. My sorry. Slide number 20. Stocks and bonds in retirement. Many advisors suggest that retirees shed the bulk of their stock investments in favor of bonds and cash investments. Well, you know, this was a great strategy 100 years ago, even 50 years ago, when people just didn't live that long. But people are living much, much, much longer, folks. A 50-year-old today, this is a statistic I read. Actually, I heard it from National Public Radio, which is, I know some people don't like them, but they're pretty much reality-based when they do their science programming. A 50-year-old living today has a 50-50 chance of living to see 100 years old, which for many of us is a pretty scary statistic. But I'm excited. I want to live to at least 100 because that'll be 2057. That'll be so cool. As you near retirement, dear students, start migrating your investments from stocks to bonds. But in my humble opinion, and somebody else is going to give you a different answer, don't abandon stocks entirely. And here's where I want you to, this is in the face-to-face, we would jump to these illustrations. So here's where I want you to go to the website and see the illustrations for bonds and stocks and then balance, bonds and stocks. So bonds versus stocks and then versus bonds and stocks. And you'll see that bonds were very stable, but they didn't really do much. They didn't, I mean, at the very least, we got to keep what we had. Whereas stocks were volatile, but oh my goodness, did they do well for us? Even after 2000 to 2002 bear market, even after 2008 to 2009. Slide number 21. Stocks versus bonds versus a balanced approach. Here we see who did the best. And notice that over the last 25 years, who did right? We know that. We knew that. We know that stocks are going to do better than bonds over the long term, because if they don't, that means the economy is really falling apart, and eventually the bonds won't be paid back. But there were times when United States Treasury bonds did much better than the stock market, especially when it dropped 37%, the S&P 500 in 2008. But if we put a 60%, 40% bond stock and bond portfolio, it turns out that we smoothed out the bumps along the way. You see, 2008 was still not fun, but instead of losing 37%, we lost 22%. So instead of our $100,000 going down to 60, whatever that was, 63,000, it went down to 78,000. That's the difference, right? And let's read. Having a balanced portfolio means that you almost never have the best returns in any one year. But it also means you will very rarely ever have the worst returns in any one year also. In addition, although it is very unlikely that you will not equal or surpass an all-stock portfolio, you should do much better than an all-bond portfolio. Yeah, but you know what we're already going to, we're going to add. Right, there are no guarantees. And many people are just too darn frightened in their retirement. They haven't taken Business 121 to trust that the world is not going to end. And if the world does end, it doesn't matter where your money is. So they will go out and buy an annuity, which is a guaranteed investment, which means you're guaranteed to get horrible results. And we'll discuss annuities in a presentation upcoming. Remember, I'm a life insurance agent as well as a stockbroker, so I can say nasty things about stockbrokers and nasty things about life insurance agents. Slide 22. Dollar cost averaging. Does this guy look familiar? I'm banging on the desk. I hope you can hear that too. This is from Chapter 4 when we took a look at mutual funds. A system of buying an investment at regular intervals with a fixed dollar amount, which is pretty much the only way most of us working grunts are going to invest anyway, in our 401k, Roth IRA, $100 a month. Go back and look at those $100 a month for 30 years, 40 years illustrations back in Chapter 4. The cool thing about dollar cost averaging, folks, is that you don't worry about where the market's going to go because you don't care. There is always good news. If the market's up, that's good news. Yippee! Because your account is worth more. Yeah, your $100 is now $100.50. It went up 0.5%. The market's down. Good news. These people don't understand this, but this is absolutely true. If you have a long-term perspective, next month you're going to get more shares at a lower price when the $50 or $100 comes out of your paycheck or checking account. Is it a guarantee of success? No. If the market just keeps falling and falling, your investments keep falling and falling, great, I'm getting more shares. But right. And that's what I would tease my wife. She's inculcated. She's already been convinced. She's already been brainwashed. But when we first met, she was scared to death of stocks. And I would tell her, Anita, because that's her name. I said, Anita, tomorrow morning when we wake up, there's good news. And she'd roll her eyes and say, sure thing, Piano. Yeah, right. no matter what. The market's up, good news. The market's down, good news. Yeah. Slide number 23. Here's an example. And back in chapter 4, I asked you to memorize the saying, your average cost per share should be less than your average price per share. And I'm going to ask you to memorize it again because you've already forgotten it. But look at this example. And this example has been used in many books and many articles and the like. In fact, they usually use these same numbers. The first year, you put in $1,000. The second year, you put in $1,000. The third year, you put in $1,000. Well, let's say it's $100 a month or whatever. That's $83.33, by the way, per month. And the first year, you bought them all at the same time, and they were $10 a share. Let's say it's a mutual fund. You have 100 shares, and it's worth $1,000. But the next year, 2008 comes along, and it goes down 50%. Ouch. But you still put in the $1,000. So now the shares are $5, and it's 200 shares that you buy. Your cumulative shares are now 300. And then the next year, 2008 comes, 9 comes along after 2008, 2009 and 10, and this investment jumps 50%. So now you're at $750. So you buy the same amount, $1,000, at $7.50, and you receive 133.333333 shares. And your cumulative total shares now is 433 shares, .33333. And you look at the prices of the shares, and you say, well, I broke even. I bought some shares at $10, some shares at $5, and some shares at $7.50. But no, you did better than broke even. Your average cost per share is only $6.92 because you bought fewer shares when the price was high and more shares when the price was low. The price per share is currently $7.50, so although it looks like you should have simply broken even, you actually made money because you bought more shares at the lower price. The value of the shares is actually $3,250. So you invested $3,000, but you're up. Now, this is a very extreme example. This is not what normally happens to your investment. But it's the same idea. You're going to put in $100 a month or $50 or more if you can afford it, and then next year put in $110. That's the key, is to up it every year or up it when you get a raise. And then as it goes down, you buy more shares. As it goes up, you buy fewer shares, and it is not a guarantee. But it's pretty darn close to being as drop-dead simple investing as there can be. And as we said, it's pretty much the only way most of us working grunts are going to invest. Who has $10,000 lying around the house? Slide 24. By always investing the same amount of money, you are purchasing more shares when the price is low and fewer shares when the price is high. This is the sentence I want you to memorize. Your average cost per share should be lower than your average price per share. However, as we've already said, I'm repeating myself, my apology, it is not a guarantee of success. Dollar cost averaging is not going to help a lousy investment turn a handsome profit. But it does make investing very, very easy for the vast majority of us. For mutual funds, that is. It's a bit trickier with stocks and bonds, but not impossible. How do you buy $50 bonds or stocks with $50 a month? What you have to do is you have to let the $50, $100 a month accumulate to about $1,000, maybe a little less, and then you buy your stocks. So bonds, they want you to buy 10 bonds, so they want $10,000. So yeah, bonds are a little tricky. Bonds are for very rich people, folks. And so, but unless you want to buy bonds from the U.S. Treasury, and then your $1,000 buys a bond at the U.S. Treasury, folks, using treasurydirect.gov, but you already knew that. Slide 25. Speaking of mutual funds, wasn't diversification one of the two main reasons why so many investors choose mutual funds in the first place? Yes. The other is professional management. And the other is because that's what's in their 401k. But does that mean mutual funds necessarily have less risk than individual portfolios or the market as a whole? Well, it all depends on which mutual funds we're talking about, right? You can go to Morningstar and finance.yahoo.com and many other websites and enter a mutual fund. And these are two of my favorite mutual funds, Dodge & Cox Stocks and Washington Mutual Investors Fund. Have nothing to do with the Washington Mutual Bank that's gone, which was actually a savings loan. Find the link to risk. And yes, your assignment for Chapter 11 is to take a look at least five mutual funds. Do the ones in your 401k. Do the ones in your Roth IRA. Or do some of the ones that I point you in the direction of. And see how they compare to the market as a whole, to their category, their type of mutual fund, and how their return is. Because some mutual funds have tremendous risk as measured by standard deviation. But that doesn't mean they're going to do badly. It doesn't mean they're going to do poorly. And some mutual funds have much less risk as measured by standard deviation, which we've already learned is a bad measurement. Okay. Slide 26. Speaking of correlation and mutual funds, many market historians have observed the tendency of mutual fund inflows and outflows to be a fairly reliable contrarian indicator of market performance. What? What they're saying here, folks, is that many investors are stupid. And we knew that, didn't we? Yes, exactly. They wait for the market to go up 100%, 200%, and then they say, ooh, is it too late to get in? And then they put their money in, and the market quickly falls 30%, 40%, and they go, ooh, is it too late to get out? And then they get out just as the market turns around. And so what we're seeing here, folks, is the return on equities as measured by the global all-country world daily total return index. And the green bars, that's the brown, it's on my screen it's brown, line, the green bars are the inflows, positive, or outflows, negative, into stock mutual funds. Equity funds, as they're called. So you see, in the late 90s, when the market was zooming, what we saw is people just start to just dump tons of cash into mutual funds. And then as it started to fall, that started to fall, until finally in 2002, at the bottom, people pulled out. There were net outflows out of mutual funds just in time for the market to come back, and then we see the investors jumping back in. Ooh, is it too late to get in? And then 2008 comes along, and we see huge outflows at the bottom of the market when it was the worst possible time to sell your money, to sell your mutual funds. This is when you should be buying, right? Yeah, well, no, that was the Warren Buffetts of the world. The rest of us working grunts were selling, and then the market comes screaming back. And sure enough, it takes a while, but people start putting money in. But then 2011, when the S&P 500, no, not the S&P, Standard & Poor's, the company, not the S&P 500, but Standard & Poor's downgraded the United States Treasury from AAA to AA+, people, again, dumped money out of the mutual funds. And we don't have 2013 here, but we should see 2013 go wee up. You know, 2013 was a great year, and they dumped it out just in time for the market to do 30% in 2013. So, are you going to be one of these mutual fund investors that waits until the market goes way up before you put your money in, and then way down before you take your money? No, you are not going to do that. If you do, I'm going to come haunt you, okay? Because you took Business 123, and you know that that's the absolute worst thing to do. Enough said. Slide 27. And dear students, we are finished the entire semester. Well, no, not really. But for the vast majority of us, folks, we are finished in terms of what you will be putting your money into throughout your investing career, if you're like many people. What we're going to do now is turn our attention to some odds and ends, most of which I hope you stay far away from. gold, commodities, precious metals, collectibles, art, real estate, tricky, but it could be very, very profitable. But first, we start with one of the most dangerous, the most speculative gambling asset classes there are, and that is stock options. So when we come back, we will be beginning stock options, and we will be doing our best to explain how they work, which is not easy, and we will be doing our best to convince you to stay far away from these things, folks, because they're just gambling. In a nutshell. See you in our next chapter when we begin the odds and ends of our semester and things that are not as important to the average, high-quality, long-term-oriented, prudent investor. And I hope that this did pull things together. If not, I want to hear from you. If it did, I'd like to hear from you also. See ya!